Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and this is a special day for us.
Yes. Now, I want to read this to you. So for folks who listen to us regularly, you will know that I had a daughter. She is now 5 months old and teething. And the only way that I'm able to get any work done is my mom is amazing and she will take her for me. But I don't like to just shove the baby at her. I like to ask first. So when we found out we were going to be interviewing Eddie, my dad said, you know, is that all right, Alice? Can we do it then? And I said, yeah, let's just double check with her. And my dad said, we'll ask as soon as she gets home. And my mom responded, I will die for Eddie Marsan. And my dad replied, no need to go that far. So to give you a sense, we are a household of fans.
Yes, oh, that's very sweet.
We are, in fact, if not in actual issuance of cards,
yeah,
card carrying members of the Eddie Marsan Fan Club, Los Angeles Bureau.
It's true.
That's very sweet. That's very sweet. Thank you.
We've been following you a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine that the numbers of our fan club have swelled, in fact, since Ray Donovan's premiere some time back now, because it has brought you into, you know, literally millions of homes.
It always surprises me how big Ray Donovan is in the States, because I would always shoot the season and then go back to the UK. Mm-hmm. And so I was never in the US when it came out, and it's kind of it has a cult following in the UK, but it's not as big as the US.
Right.
And then we went back recently to shoot the finale movie in New York. Mm-hmm. And the affection that people have for those characters. Mm. It's just incredible. They absolutely adore the family. And I've never had that before. I've never really been identified with the character before, you know, where people have kind of ownership. And it was very nice.
Did you find that you thrived on the continuity of that character? I mean, Terry, who was one of three brothers, three Donovan brothers, has quite a heart tugging, I guess, is the word.
Yeah. Yes,
character arc. I mean, you really do feel his pain and care about what's going to happen to him.
And my dad has Parkinson's, so. Watching you do what you did, first, all I could think was, ouch. But also, I mean, talk about physical embodiment of a character.
Yes, it was. Well, the first thing about the fascinating thing about Terry Donovan that we developed with the writers, and because it was such a long running show, there was a kind of collaborative, cyclical osmosis between the writing room and me playing Terry Donovan. So we would kind of inform each other. Mm. The fascinating thing about Terry Donovan was the paradox that was inherent within the character, because he was really tough. He was an ex-boxer. He would beat people up all the time. And yet he was... In function, he was the mother of the family. He did everything that a Catholic mother would do, including not divorce Mickey Donovan.
Yeah.
So he was very feminine while being very, very macho.
Yeah.
And also had a disability. So that was one of the things why I think is most attractive about the character. Secondly, the Parkinson's, we took great care to study Parkinson's to get it as authentic as we could. But secondly, what was inherent within the character was that Terry was morally between a rock and a hard place when he was about 12 years old, because his mother was dying of cancer. And yet the priest who was giving his mother comfort was also abusing his brothers. Yeah. So if he would have told his mother, she would have lost the comfort and died sooner. And his brother, so he didn't know what to do. Yeah. So he was kind of morally between a rock and a hard place. And that the shape was a manifestation of that, was someone who was always didn't know what to do. And that was really useful psychologically to keep that in every scene.
Is it like, I don't know, because I'm not an actor. I've never committed to a long-term TV series as you did with this one. Is it kind of like being in a long-running play where you're exploring different facets or unlocking new doors every time you go on?
Yes, in a sense. The thing that was most similar to me was doing a Mike Lee film.
Oh, yeah.
Because Mike Lee, you would develop a character over 6 months before you started shooting. So you would really know the character. And when you got to like the second or third season of Ray Donovan, you really knew this character. Mm. And also it was created in collaboration with Dash Myhawk and Liev Schreiber and Pooch Hall and John Voight. So we all kind of created this dynamic together. So that was the thing it was most similar to, I believe, in my experience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you do all feel like a family. And as you say, that's why, you know, here in the States, people are obsessed with the show. Mm. And I always laugh when someone becomes famous for a role where they're not using their own accent. And then people
yes.
find out that you're not American. It does. It makes me laugh just because, you know, I'm an Anglophile proudly.
Right.
I imported my husband from Manchester but that's our home away from home. And I do it. I always laugh because you'll see certain actors that come out here, even Idris Elba, someone like that, where people only heard him be American and you find out, oh no. Oh no, no,
right.
No.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, it was always really funny when we would do press for Ray Donovan or we'd do big Q&As, because there's a natural colloquialism within America, especially if you live in America, where you kind of know that. And because I never lived in America, they would go to the brothers and Liev would speak about Ray and his colloquialism was kind of similar to the Bostonian language he was using. It was kind of, it was similar in Pooch and Dash, and they would all kind of be similar to the characters. And then they'd ask me, and you could see the audience go, who's this guy?
Yeah.
Because I was speaking this English accent, and they were kind of, and also because I was trying to explain something, my semantics would be more British. Mm-hmm. And there's this thing in America where you think which is wrong, I think, but we sound more intelligent than
oh,
we
yeah.
are.
Oh yeah.
And so people think you could see people would expect me to be Terry Donovan, and I'm not Terry Donovan, and especially women were always disappointed when I wasn't Terry Donovan.
As long as it wasn't your wife, you're fine.
No, it's fine. It wasn't my wife. It's fine.
There is this American phenomenon. It's amusing that you mention it, that we are such suckers for British accents.
It is. It is. Yeah. It really is. It's really strange. And yeah. I don't really know where it comes from, really. I do think America has an amazing colloquial language. You know, you have a kind of, because I think your national story is about meritocracy and whether that's true or not, but your narrative is, so you have this love of the everyman. So You'll even have Joe Biden saying, "Oh man, come on, man, don't be." You know, you have
right,
all this.
Right.
We don't have that. Do you know what I mean? We don't have that colloquial. We don't celebrate colloquialism like you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's a warmth, isn't it? That's why people use that, especially politicians, because it makes them not seem like higher or separate or more.
Exactly.
Important.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so different. Well, I mean, even when you see Parliament meeting in the UK, or you see the way people still dress,
it's formal. More formal.
Very different. I will say, I always laugh because obviously Americans can't seem to tell the difference between the accents. So my husband,
I bet you can now.
She's got a very good ear. So,
I've lived all over the UK for a long, long time. Right. But no, to me, obviously, my husband's from Manchester. He sounds nothing like you.
Yes.
But people can't tell which I just find really funny. People can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't be further apart. But and when did you first play American? What was the first time you did that?
I did 21 grams for Alejandro González Iñárritu, and I played the Baptist preacher opposite Benicio del Toro.
Oh, Benicio, sure.
Yeah. So I played opposite Benicio and Naomi, actually. And that was the first time I played American.
Were you nervous?
Yeah, I worked hard, really hard on it. I always work hard on accents.
Yeah.
Even in Britain, because I'm actually very, very, I come from Bethnal Green. And I actually have a very, very strong Cockney accent naturally.
Really?
I have a very, very, I suppose it's working class accent, really. And we have a terrible snobbery in the UK. One of the reasons why I went to America to work was because I got better range of parts in America than I did in the UK. Huh.
That thing of sounding common, again, so fascinating. Adele's accent here, people enjoy it. They think it's great. I remember when she first became famous and my friends over there, she just sounds so common.
Yes. Yeah. I have a similar accent to Adele. Yeah. Yeah. We have an inbuilt snobbery in this country.
Yeah.
How interesting. And yet, what really knocked me for a loop when I saw you playing a Latino drug dealer in Miami Vice.
Oh yeah.
Typecasting, right?
And I said, why on earth would they have reach across the Atlantic Ocean to find.
Yeah, I know. Guy. I know. It was amazing. It was a lovely part to play. I really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. It was great fun. Great fun. I love working in America. It's my favorite place to work. I love the stories. I love it.
What's the best location you've had on an American shoot?
I think Miami Vice was pretty amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think Miami Vice was pretty amazing where we shot there. I did a movie for David Leitch's, that David Leitch's wife produced, that called A Kind of Murder, where we shot in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. I love going to places like Cincinnati and we shot Concussion in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I love going to those places because they're the kind of places you don't go to if you're British.
Exactly.
Kind of East Coast. I love going to 21 Grams was shot in Memphis. I love those places where they're hidden places. For us, they would be hidden because they're not touristy. You know, I love those places.
Yeah. I think it's funny, but if you're someone who enjoys travel, that is, I'm the same. I love visiting friends in small places I would never otherwise go.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's an adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. It's like going to Manchester rather than London.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time in random places in the Midlands. So that's
brilliant.
When you tell people it's like, oh, I've been to Codsall. Oh yeah. I was in this place. Then they go, why? Like friends, you
that's
just
it,
know.
But that's where you get a taste for it. That's where you really get a sense of it. Yeah,
big
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Now you were headed for a career as a printer, as I understand
it. I was, yes. I just finished my apprenticeship as a printer when I gave it up to become an actor. Yeah.
And what caused that turn?
Me and my buddies used to dance a lot in clubs in the East End of London. And someone came and asked us to be extras in a movie. And I was on a film set one day and I saw an actor friend of mine do a scene. He's now a friend of mine. Then he was just quite a big star. And I saw him do a scene where he had to walk across the dance floor. And when I saw him, something just clicked in my mind and thought, I'm going to do that. That's what I can do. But it took me years to earn a living as an actor. I mean, I was nearly 30 before I was earning a living.
You really have to love it because...
You have to. It has to be a necessity. Michael Caine says you don't want to be an actor. You have to be an actor.
Yeah. That's a perfect way to describe it. Mm. Absolutely. Because it is. It's a lot of rejection. It's a lot of work. And you just have to... It has to mean so much that you're willing to go through it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, I was very excited when I heard that there is, in fact, a new Mike Lee film percolating and about to
Yes, there is.
Well, that I will never forget being in Telluride at the film festival and watching Happy Go Lucky, which obviously is a film that did really well with all the critics, which is always nice when critics like something. But I remember sitting there and watching and there you were. I mean, that character is a lot. That character is intense. Obviously it comes full circle. And my dad is a Mike Lee devotee. So he knew better than I did where this was gonna go. But man, oh man.
Well, it's one of your most memorable characters, I have to say. And yes. I don't think I'm alone in that opinion. But where did that guy come? You play a traffic school instructor.
Yes.
Sally right. Hawkins has the misfortune of of getting as her teacher. And you're kind of obsessive and a bit
angry.
Angry. Yeah, not angry. I was gonna say mean spirited, but that's not it. It's
no,
angry.
He's angry.
A yes. lot of pent yes. up anger that you release.
Yes, yes. Well, we just finished Vera Drake, mm-hmm. and Mike was going to do his next movie, and he said to me,
I'm going to interrupt you. I'm sorry. You just finished Vera Drake, where you play the sweetest man on earth.
Yes. Yeah, that's one thing about Mike that I love, is that he believes in actors. There is a tendency now in the world, because I think of reality television, to mm-hmm. think that casting is a kind of anthropological exercise where you find the real thing. I don't believe in that. I believe that acting is a craft, and that I think authenticity is valuable, but the ability to portray authenticity is a separate craft. And I think Mike Lee completely understands that. So he knew the character I played in Vera Drake, and then would say to me, now I want you to do something completely different. Mm-hmm. And that's what was brilliant and really generous as a filmmaker and a director to give me that opportunity. So he asked me to play this part, and he said, can you go and study the conspiracy theories for a year? I had to go and study conspiracy theories, and I went into the deep, dark web for a year. Most of the thing I think is most of these guys just want a girlfriend, really. That's what it is. They had a girlfriend there, you know, and I think that's what it was about. And what's fascinating is when you see that character, and it was before the invention of social media. But now that character is prevalent all over the world.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can see that character. That, there's lots of men suffering from a degree of toxic masculinity and feeling disenfranchised, and they're not being loved, and they're feeling rejected, and they have no hope, and they turn to anger, and they turn to conspiracy theories. And that's what that character was back then.
It is. I mean, even with social media, of course, it's so different because you know things about people that you would never know. You know, someone has a baby and you know the baby's name and when they were born. What a strange thing. I mean, even for you, you are in general a fairly smiley and warm human being. And, you know, there's all these pictures. You have a beautiful family. And, you know, there you are with them again, smiling, looking like this is the life. And then you play these really tough characters. And if all someone knows is what they see online, it's harder for them to sort of have a blank slate. And that's the good and the bad of social media.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, exactly. It's very reductive. Yes. It completely reductive. And that's why it's not, that's why even political discourse, I've come to realize now that you can never convince anybody or persuade anybody on social media because it's a perpetual argument. It's better to persuade people through art and through films and through drama. Yes. Much better. Yeah.
Amen to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will. You just tweeted the other day about someone that I love who we lost a year ago. And that is Paul Ritter. And I just wanted to ask you, were you friends? Did you work with him? He was such a talent.
Yes. He was my favorite actor for years. And then a few years ago, I was asked to do a short film for Sky TV in the UK. They were doing this collection of stories called Urban Myths. And there's an urban myth about Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics inviting Bob Dylan to come to Crouch End to visit him. And Bob Dylan went to the wrong house and knocked on the door and said, "Is Dave there?" And the woman said, "Yeah, he'll be back in a while." And he went in and sat in this guy in this living room, waited for this guy called Dave. And then this plumber called Dave came back and Bob Dylan was in his house. And they spent the afternoon together. And it's a true story. And they asked me to play Bob Dylan. And then they asked Paul Ritter to play Dave. And so we did this wonderful short film together. So you should watch it, it's beautiful. But he was my favorite actor. I first saw him do The Three Sisters at the Royal Court when I just left drama school. And he did this speech that I'd seen people do in drama school for the last 4 years. Every week someone did it. And when he got on stage to do it, he was so brilliant that I didn't even realize it was that speech until about half the way through.
Wow.
Because he was so creative, such a brilliant actor. And we lost him a year ago. And a friend of mine, Tamsin Gregg, contacted me
amazing,
that day.
And amazing actress.
She said to me, it's been a year this year. And I hadn't been on social media for a while, but I thought I want people to remember him this year.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted at the anniversary, I just wanted people to remember him because he was so brilliant.
It is fascinating. Again, the good and bad of social media. It's fascinating to see who was beloved among their peers when they passed.
Yes. And he was beloved.
But that, you know, Sean Locke passed away not that long ago.
Yes.
And it's a very similar reaction.
Yes.
And when Paul passed, I loved Friday Night Dinner. I will recommend to anyone, watch Friday Night Dinner. It's one of the funniest things, not just because we're Jewish, but my God, it's one of the funniest things you will ever watch in your life.
Yes.
And I love Tamsin Gregg. I love her. But Paul Ritter plays the father in that. And oh my, he's just brilliant. And when he passed away, you had all of these people talking about how he was their favorite actor. You know? And I just thought, what a legacy.
Yeah, he was, because he was just, even if you see him in things like Chernobyl, and he's in the film at the moment that's just come out with, in the UK. And he's what I want to be. He's what I aspire to be as an actor. He has all the qualities that I try to achieve.
I think you succeed at that, but it's true. I wanted to bring him up just because I want more people, especially here. I want more people here to learn about him.
Yes.
They say, for me, same with Sean Locke, because that man makes me laugh so hard. And he's another one that I always want Americans to find out about, because he's just, his deadpan will just kill you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're in a big mainstream American action adventure film starring Chris Pine right now called The Contractor.
Really good cast.
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
And you work a lot. Yeah. I mean, even by working actor standards, you work a lot. Then, of course, you have four kids.
Four kids. Yeah, that'll do it.
Four kids. There you go. Yeah.
A lot of mouths to feed. But what makes you say yes? Or conversely, what makes you turn down a role?
Well, I always try to do something that I've never done before. Or the next thing I do, I want it to be completely different from the thing I did before. This was The Contractor was a great script. Tarek Seller, the director, had worked with me on Ray Donovan. And he was one of my favorite directors on Ray Donovan. He actually encouraged me in playing Terry Donovan to concentrate more on the feminine nature of Terry Donovan, the compassion and the caring and the loving and the tenderness. And I thought he brought out a better performance from me. And then he asked me to do this, and he described the character as being in a section of the film where the audience has to have a breather, and we have to sit in with the humanity of this man, and in a way that Chris Pine's character does as well. And he said, "I want you to do it." And I thought it was a great compliment to ask me to bring that color to this movie, which is a real alpha male shoot 'em up movie.
Yeah.
And then to ask me to come in to do that, it's the kind of thing I think you would have asked Philip Seymour Hoffman to do 15 years ago, or you would ask Paul Giamatti to do. And to me, it was a great compliment to be asked to bring this color to this film. So so that's why I did it.
Well, good choice.
Yes.
Good choice. So would you say you're the lemon sorbet between between courses of a good meal?
Exactly. Yeah. That's 100% what I am.
a CV has special skills.
Yes.
Palate cleanser.
Yes.
There you go. Man.
Now, you've played a handful, not too many, if I did my homework right. You've played a handful of real life figures on screen.
Yes.
The one that rings out to me is John Houseman in Me and Orson Welles.
Yes.
Franklin played
yes.
a wonderful film. A too little scene.
Yeah.
Film.
Yes.
About the heyday of Orson Welles and his Mercury Theater troupe in the late 1930s in New York. And yet it was shot, of all places, on the Isle of Man, yeah. right?
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
Well, who would dream that would double so well
yeah.
for 1930s Manhattan? But it did.
Yeah, that was a great film. I love that. And Zac Efron was wonderful.
He was.
Really,
yeah,
it's one, that's
brilliant
one of the
in that
first,
part.
It's one of the first good roles he had.
Like, yeah,
it showed you he was more, you know?
Did you watch and study John Houseman?
I did. To a certain degree, I did. I was fascinated by him because he was actually Jewish. I think he was actually born in Romania, mm-hmm. and yet he kind of that kind of thing within Jewish culture where you can pass, where you don't look Jewish, and you take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of created this persona of this English gent. And yes. I found that absolutely fascinating. As someone who always creates someone else for a living, for someone who did that as a choice to
right.
probably deal with prejudice or to deal with anxiety or whatever he did, to do that was an amazing as a character, you know. And then he got an Oscar for it years later.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yes.
Playing an imperious law school professor.
Yes, yes.
The paper
yes.
Chase, indeed.
Yes, yes.
I think Jacques Haussmann was his birth name.
Yes, that's right, yes.
So interesting. And then I see that you've more recently played Heinrich Himmler.
I have. I have.
How does one play Heinrich Himmler?
Well, I tell you what, there was a really fascinating way into playing Himmler, which was to read the love letters to his wife. He sent love letters to his wife. And what was fascinating was he would number them. And he had a mistress. And when she began to feel that he didn't love her, when she began to become insecure, she would say, "Don't you love me? You haven't told me you love me, Heinrich." And he would say, "I did tell you. I refer you back to number 34 when I wrote that." And I thought that's a fascinating way to play this character.
Oh, my.
There's a man who's so cold and clinical. Oh. But then I played Bob Dylan, which is brilliant to play, you know. Yeah, I had to smoke 20 cigarettes a day just to sound like him. But
oh Lord.
Oh dear. That's giving your all for your art.
Yeah.
Again, typecasting. It's because of your curls.
Yes, I think it is. Yeah.
Similar
I wasn't as gray then as I am now.
Now you've worked for some pretty imposing directors, not always in the juiciest parts, but I wonder if you can give us a sense of what it's like being on a Martin Scorsese set, as you were with Gangs of New York.
It was really a good lesson for me, actually, of being on a Martin Scorsese set, because there was one scene, I remember one scene where he walked on set. We were shooting this set in a Chinese brothel. And we were all there. There was Daniel Day-Lewis, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jim Broadbent. We were all there. And Martin walked in and he looked around and there was Michael Houseman's when they were looking around trying to work out what to do. And then he just said in front of everybody, "I don't know what to do next." And I remember as a relatively young actor thinking this is the great Martin Scorsese. He's got the courage to say, "I don't know what to do." And that's what makes him brilliant, I think, in that he's not afraid of that, of going, of losing sight of the shore to cross the ocean. Do you know what I mean? He's prepared to take that risk. And for me, I remember thinking when he said that, I think, well, if you don't know what you're doing, I'm not having to worry about it. I'm fine. I don't know what I'm doing. And I learned that from him. And he was very encouraging. We would have fascinating talks and things. I'm a big Sinatra fan. And I would have talks to him about what Sinatra meant to the Italian-American community. And
sure.
And how artistically, what he represented. I would love to have those chats with Marty and all that stuff, you know. Yeah.
I want to ask you the same question about being on a Steven Spielberg set as you work for War Horse.
What I loved about Steven Spielberg was that he had the enthusiasm of a film student, but with all that money and backing behind him. So what he would do was, the first thing he did was, I was told they want me to do War Horse. I didn't know what part I was playing. And my kids loved the story of War Horse. And at the time I had four young children. They're teenagers now. I had four young kids. And I said, "Daddy's doing War Horse." And they were really excited. "My daddy's going to be in War Horse." And they went to school and told everybody, "Daddy's going to be in War." And I walked on set and Stephen came up, shook my hand. He said, "Eddie, there was only ever going to be one person who was going to kill this horse, and that's you."
Oh, my gosh.
And I remember thinking, oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
My kids are going to die. But what he was amazing was, is that he dances with the camera. He directs like, I was recently directed by Sean Penn in Flag Day. And Sean and Stephen have a similar technique in that they know what they want, but they don't set in stone what they're going to get until they see it.
Mm.
And so what Stephen would do would come on and say, "Oh, look, we can do this with the camera. We can do this. Let's try this." And he had an enthusiasm, like a boyish enthusiasm with different shots. And that's why he's so brilliant at telling a story, because he looks at what's going on and then says, "Now we're going to do this." And it's spontaneous. He dances with the camera and he dances with the actors as well. And Sean Penn does that brilliantly.
Isn't that interesting? There's something, it's, you know, the directors you're talking about, someone like Martin Scorsese, someone like Steven Spielberg. I think part of what people love about them is they're so passionate about movies, but they don't talk about them like scholars necessarily.
No, I mean,
they can, exactly. Obviously they can, but they just love it. And they're so excited to do what they do. And
well, yes, exactly. Well, movies aren't academic. Right. They're visceral. They're visceral, and that's the difference. And these guys have a visceral love of it. They're not academics, you know, and that's the difference. It's why I don't do much theater. I do film because I'm not academically trained. I'm kind of like a session musician in a sense.
That's a really interesting comparison.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, session musicians are known for being able to do whatever's called upon to do on the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
So that's exactly. A high compliment.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
It's true. I mean, without them, you don't have a song. So
No, exactly.
All right, I'm going to do one more, knowing that this is a contrast. You were on a Woody Allen set for Match Point.
I was. For one day, and I got cut from the movie. I don't think I'm even in the movie.
Oh, dear.
I was cut. Yeah, one day. It was all right. I mean, it was kind of, I just wanted to experience what it would be like.
Of course.
And it was there was, I forget what the lead was now, the young Irish actor, the good-looking guy. He was doing a scene in Office. Yeah, it was one scene, but it got cut. So I get credit for being on a Woody Allen movie, but I'm not in it.
Yeah. Counts with us.
Yeah. That's such a, to me, I always think about it. It's almost like you're going to a new school all the time. Like you're the new kid coming on to set, certainly with TV shows that already exist when you come in.
Yes.
But
yes.
Even with films, I think it takes, talk about building up a thick skin to walk into these new situations again and again and again. I think it takes a lot of bravery.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, when you get to my age, and I think I've done 120 films now or something, you've kind of very rarely do you turn up and not know someone.
Sure.
You always know someone, I think, on the crew or within the makeup department or the cast. So you always kind of, I think I always know someone.
Sure.
But I think early on, I think it was difficult for me, but I learned a lot from Jim Broadbent. I spent 9 months with Jim Broadbent on Gangs of New York, and I learned from him how to behave on a film set, how to keep your powder dry and to keep focused in what you're doing. He was brilliant.
Another legend.
What's the best thing he taught you?
Just that it's not about you. That it's not about you. You know, there's no need to get overconfident, and there's no need to get insecure. They're both the same thing. They're both sides of the same coin, and don't spend that coin. You know,
interesting.
You're like a member of the crew. Just do your job. He was brilliant at that. Yeah.
Well, the great American actor Walter Huston once gave a younger actor a piece of advice. He said, don't ever let them put your name above the title and you'll work forever. You'll work forever. And it looks like that's what's happening to you. You are a character actor who has attained some, you know, deserved notoriety and fame.
But you're still able to play everything.
But you can play any kind of part.
Yes. Yeah. I'm really lucky in that sense. It's a great place. It's a real sweet spot to be.
Yeah.
And it also means that people don't have an idea of me. I don't mean that in a bad sense, but it means it affords you a kind of privacy, especially when I have young children. It makes daddy's job just a job. I'm not a celebrity. I'm just an actor.
Yeah. One of my favorite films of yours is perhaps one of the least seen, at least here in the States, 66.
Oh, yes. Yes.
What a lovely film of memory, and it's about a guy recalling his bar mitzvah, and the events surrounding his bar mitzvah, and his father, who was a bit of a character, shall we say?
Yes. Yeah, that was a great. That was Paul Whelan directed that film, and he wrote it. It was about his father. He was the boy who had the bar mitzvah from the World Cup final. And his father, Manny, had OCD. But the weird thing is, I play a lot of Jewish parts, especially in the UK, because I don't think I necessarily look Jewish, but a lot of the Jewish filmmakers, they cast me because I sound like their fathers and grandfathers. Mm-hmm. Because their fathers and grandfathers they left Eastern Europe and went to the East End of London. And I have this East End accent, natural East End accent. So, and I would naturally, growing up, they would speak a little of Yiddish anyway, as a kind of terminology, you know. And so they listened to me and they put a bit more Yiddish in, and suddenly I'm their grandfather. And they go, oh my God, that's just what he sounded like. And Paul Whelan's dad run a grocery store on Watney Market. My dad was a barrow boy on Watney Market at the same time. So there's a kind of familiarity there, you know. It's great. I love that film. It's a beautiful film, and they put it on Netflix recently, and the affection people have for it is out of this world. Yeah,
I think that is the best part about streaming, is that films that didn't necessarily get the attention they deserved, they can come back now and people can watch them almost anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And I get messages from people on Twitter saying they saw this movie and it really affected them. And you kind of thought it had gone away and now it's come back. I'm really, really appreciate that. It's really lovely when they tell me how much it moved them.
Would you be kind enough to tell our listeners who may not know how you coped with the lockdown with four children at home?
You had a
creative solution to a problem.
We made a movie. My agent phoned me. She said, I've got a job, you're on location. I said, I can't go on location. We're not allowed to go in it. She goes, no, the location is your house. And they and they came up with a story. There was another famous actor who lived, David Threfnell, who was in the original version of Shameless in the UK. And he lives around the corner, so he could get here. And he played a granddad who was trying to see his children. And I played the dad, and two of my sons played the kids who weren't allowed to. And we did all our scenes by the glass in the garden. And it's brilliant. And my wife directed it and shot it. And it was really hard work. And my two sons were in it. I've got four children, but two of my sons were in it. And it was brilliant to do. And then the thing is, they sat down and the whole country watched it because they had nothing else to
do. Right.
Yeah. It was the biggest viewing figures I've ever had.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful.
Yeah, very funny. It was a lovely thing to do, actually, in lockdown. I was very proud to do it. Yeah.
Of course.
What was interesting was, it was better to do it within the restrictions of lockdown. If you'd have done it retrospectively, it wouldn't have had the same emotional response.
Yeah.
But they knew we were making this movie and giving testimony to this experience within the same restrictions.
It's such a
necessity being the mother of invention.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So do your kids want to act, or is it the kind of thing where maybe
Two of them, my daughter's has a film coming out with Vanessa Redgrave. It's coming out this year. My son was in a movie with Hugh Bonneville where my son played the young, what's his name? Who wrote Charlie in the Chocolate Factory?
Roald Dahl.
Yeah, my son played the young Roald Dahl, opposite Hugh Bonneville, who plays Roald Dahl. And so the two of my kids are kind of showing an interest, but they grew up on film sets.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
It is addictive best way.
It is.
A set is so even when you're sitting for 17 hours and you're bored, there's just something about it.
Yes.
And especially if you grew up, because of my dad, I grew up on sets and it feels like home.
Yes. And also if you grow up on sets, you have a different appreciation of it. You have a very healthy approach to it, like a workman-like approach to it. Mm-hmm. Because you would sit, you know, at the lunch table, there would be other filmmakers there. My wife was a makeup artist. My my kids' godparents are actors, so they have this approach to it where it isn't some kind of America's Got Talent thing. It's a job,
yeah.
And you do it, and you do it well. And mm-hmm. my kids have got that appreciation of it. Yeah.
Well,
that's so special.
They've been raised properly.
Yeah. What are their names? So if people watch, what are their names?
Oh, my daughter is Tilly Marsan, and then my son who acts is Bodhi Marsan. But I've got Tilly's 17, Blue is 16, Bodhi is 13, and then Rufus is 11. And I've got three dogs and a tortoise.
That is one hell of a lockdown.
Yeah, yeah.
And a partridge in a pear tree. Yeah, that's. Man, that is, and being creative and having the opportunity to be creative, especially with your family, is so meaningful. And it's obviously, you know, for your kids, this is just what you do, but it also means that they get to play in a way that they may not have otherwise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They really, I think they enjoyed it. I think they enjoy it. They quite like it because they understand it. Mm-hmm. Children love things. Children feel empowered by things that they understand.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, have you already made the new Sherlock Holmes movie, or is that yet to come?
No, I haven't made it. The last I heard that Robert is developing a series based on the films for HBO Max. But I haven't heard anything. They're about characters based in the series. I don't know. I haven't heard anything. I'm actually working with Jude now. So
yeah,
I'll have to ask him.
Yeah, right. Hey, Watson. It's nice that you can actually say that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, many, many people have played the character of Inspector Lestrade over many, many years' time in those Sherlock Holmes stories. Did you develop your own approach to him, or was the script very specific about just how angry or how blustery he would be?
No, I approached it. I kind of created that character with Guy. Guy wanted me to bring that element. There's a line where I say to where Robert says, I asked him about, does he have any information about the serial killer? This is in the first Sherlock Holmes. And me and Guy came up with this dialogue, which is a bit like East End dialogue, you know, because Robert says, Robert was doing a brilliant posh English accent. He says, all in good time, good fellow. And huh. I turn around and say, all in good time. It's not a parlor game. If you don't give me any information, I'll have you back in that prison quicker than a book. You'll be playing Victoria now, but quicker than a bookies runner. Which is all about, and it was that kind of diet. It was a class thing, really.
Yeah,
the Schwab was uneducated, and Sherlock Holmes was educated, and we were playing on that, really. You know,
yeah. What's it like working with Guy?
Guy Ritchie.
Yes, sorry, Guy Ritchie.
I've done five films with him now. I think five or it's great. He calls me in and just asked me, turn up, can you do this one for me? And it's like he's phoning a plumber. Can you come and fix my I do it.
Well, it's nice to know that you're reliable.
Yeah, I am.
You know?
I am, yeah.
He needs
I always say to him when he's doing a film, I always turn up and say, what do you want me to sort out now? Because if I'm not in it, it doesn't make any sense.
I love that. When did your accent change? Or when did you change your accent?
I think accents change naturally because we're like apes in the sense that we want to belong, so we copy the people around us.
Sure.
I think it also changed because of the words I was using. My vocabulary expanded. And if you don't say words naturally within an accent, your accent has to change to fit the words. Mm. And Harry Truman always said I love Harry Truman, and he always said that if you ever criticize somebody because they mispronounce a word, it's probably because they read it rather than heard it.
Mm.
Ah, interesting.
And I think that's true with me. I'm a terrible malaprop. I get words wrong. I say I mispronounce words all the time because often I've read them in a script or read them about a philosophical approach to a script, but I've never heard anyone say it, you know. So, and also because I've studied, because I do accents all the time. So my accent changed because my accent became,
sure.
I very rarely do a London accent. There's actually something coming out on PBS in the US called Ridley Road, which is about East End Jewish cab drivers taking on the British Nazi Party in the 1960s. It's a true story. And I go back to my accent then, my original accent. But usually I don't do it. Usually it's it was either Bostonian or it was Eastern European or whatever you needed me to do.
It's, I mean, the point of an actor is that they are a blank slate that can do whatever, create whatever it is you need to create. But, and as you say, it is fascinating how so many actors have these funny accents that kind of, you know, you speak to someone who's an Aussie, but they've lived here in LA for 30 years. You know, and what they eventually do is they just soften it because people can't understand them.
They do.
You know, my husband is Northern, but also mumbles. And my parents constantly go, what? so, you know, with him, he softened his accent because he's working primarily with Americans and they can't understand what he's saying.
Yeah. It's so true. It's a natural, it's not fake or anything because it's literally like apes. You need to communicate with people. And so you moderate your accent because of that. Yeah. I'm fascinated by accents. They always fascinate me.
It is. It's a whole world. And of course, in the UK, it's fascinating because they change. It's like 2 miles away.
I know. Two miles away they change. I know.
But it's, I know. You wouldn't realize if you take a train from the bottom to the top of the country, you will hear 20 different accents. I mean,
I know. And Texas is bigger than the UK.
Right.
I'm very sad because there's people are already starting to mourn the apparent demise of the Brooklyn accent.
Really?
Which was a staple of cab drivers in Hollywood movies for many, many years. And now apparently as Brooklyn has
been filled with hipsters.
Yes, exactly. Gentrified. That long-standing dialect is starting to vanish. Too bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Too bad. But a lot of that is Dutch, isn't it? A lot of the.
Well, it New started York that accent, way. Yeah.
It started from Dutch. The kind of even the word even the Brooklyn is it comes from a suburb of Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brooklyn or some of it. It's fascinating how fluid they are.
Well, I mean, if you listen to Laurel and Hardy, Oliver Hardy has a Georgia accent and he says Boyd instead of Bird. But a Brooklyn accent would say Boyd, much harder.
Yeah.
My mom's from the Bronx and we tease her all the time that she makes words rhyme that don't rhyme. You know, draw, floor. Soar, tour. What are you saying? We don't know, but it sounds adorable. That's actually, she and my husband at times have a similar accent because they both don't say R.
So, right, yes.
Like we just had the Oscars.
Yeah, the Oscars.
The Oscars,
The Oscars.
Yeah.
And we don't, and to be really clear, we're not making fun.
Oh, no.
Of
no, it is fascinating. It is. Where I come from in the East End, we don't say bagel, we say Bible.
Mm.
We have, when I went to drama school and someone offered me if I wanted a bagel, I didn't know what they, it's a bagel. And somebody told me, a linguist, a Russian Jewish linguist, in LA said to me it's because of there's no uniform vowel sound in I don't know if he said maybe mistaken Hebrew or Yiddish, but there were certain people in Ukraine where it would have been an I, and in certain people in Northern Europe it would have been an A, and there was no uniform sound. So the guys who came to the East End and opened that store, it was a bagel. So it's always been a bagel to us. not a bagel. And that's language that I find things like that absolutely fascinating.
Oh, it is fascinating. Yeah. It is. Eddie, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And
well, my pleasure to talk to you. It's been fantastic.
We encourage people to see The Contractor.
Yes.
And
it's in theaters and on digital on demand April 1st of 2022.
Which is now.
Which, P.S., I can't quite believe it's 2022.
I know.
I keep writing it and being shocked. But yeah,
it's available now. Yeah.
It's available now for people to watch. And honestly, folks, all you have to do is type Eddie's name into pretty much any streaming service, and you should find at least one. Did you say 126 films? You should find at least one.
Something. Yeah, you should find at least one.
He'll pop up.
I'm not saying you'll like it, but you'll find it.
That's, you know, he'll sell you a mattress. You know, any number of things could happen for you. Truly, we are such fans, Eddie, and it's such a pleasure to get to talk to you.
Honored to meet you. Thank you very much.
Continued success to you, sir.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Man, Eddie's everything I could hope that he would be.
You know, there's that old axiom that the baddest guys on screen are the nicest guys off screen in real life.
He's so smart and he's so kind and, really, it was very exciting for us to get to talk to him because we've watched him for so long. And, you know, as we said to him, we are huge fans. So, yay. That's a pretty good way to start the day, I'd say.
I would say there's no better way. No better way. And how do people find us in between these talks?
Well, you are at Leonard Maltin. I am at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You're also on Facebook. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And we're on Patreon.
We are on the Maltreon.
And the Patreon place is where you can help support what we do.
And we appreciate you so much.
We value every contribution, no matter how small. It really makes a difference. And for that, you go to Maltin on Movies.
So you go to patreon.com / Maltin on Movies. Patreon.com/ Maltin on Movies.
Yeah, what she said.
And if you folks don't know, we do a weekly live stream on Sundays. And you can watch it on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
And it lives on YouTube afterwards.
It lives forever on the YouTubes. We talk movies, we hang out, and it's a lot of fun.
And it's generally 2 p.m. Pacific time.
Yes.
On Sundays.
Yep. All right, friends, everybody take good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you soon.
Be kind. See you next week. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.